think we're going to get started, everybody. Hopefully the clouds will continue to hold. Welcome. I'm so happy with this lovely group of people. Thank you for being here today. I'm Galen Joseph Hunter. I'm the director of Wayfarm. I think this idea actually started... Where's Bianca?
I'm here.
Bianca started this idea, suggesting that we might want to work with Wild Hudson Valley when we were talking about trying to... we were starting work on a land acknowledgement. We didn't want to be, like, we didn't simply want to, like, come up with a text and throw it on the wall and say, we're done. We started working on the text in conjunction with Matthew O'Neill's Panther Sounds. Is that the right
Panther
title?
Mountain
Sounds. Panther Mountain Sounds radio show, which is every other week on WGXC, that features underheard Native music. So that felt like a good... like a starting point, and then Bianca suggested we work with Justin and Anna of Wild Hudson Valley to take it a step further and really start to think and talk about the history of this land in conjunction with the art park tour that we give. So Justin brought this wonderful educator, Christian Jacobs, on board and worked with us over the spring. And I'm so pleased that he's going to give you all a very well-informed tour today. So this is Justin and Anna.
Kristen Jacobs is one of the only near fluent speakers of the Muncie language once spoken in the lower half of the Hudson Valley, including this area centuries ago, which is now only spoken as a first language by one elder in her community in Ontario, the Moravian Town Reserve. We co-wrote The Sound Walk, and she read it, and she has... what's really interesting, the accent from her teacher, Diane Snake, who's the last first language speaker. I'm not going to go too far into the language stuff because it gets really nerdy. But anyway, it's reflective of how people would have been, the particular dialect that was spoken in this part of the Hudson Valley and in the Catskill Mountains. So on the walk that we're going on, I warn you in advance, it is probably going to go very slowly, as they usually do, because there is too much to see. We're going to be stopping constantly, looking at plants, looking at birds, insects, the topography, and using the landscape to go back in time. I will be hopefully helping to transport you without aid of a time machine in your minds to see what the world was like here before the arrival of Dutch colonists 400 years ago. Before we go off onto this walk through the meadows and wetlands and swamps here at Wave Farm, I'm just going to mention briefly that if you were to go back in time 500 years ago and stand where you are or sit where you are right now, and if you encounter a Native person, you'd find that they would be calling themselves, more likely than not, variations of the word Lenape, which means human being. In this particular area, a dialect of the Mohican language was spoken. The Mohican people are also Lenape, and it just means human being. A lot of people get confused by all these different terms. Their descendant communities today are usually called Delaware Indians because of the Delaware River, even if some of the communities are mostly from the Hudson Valley. The Mohican people are part of the same group coming from common ancestors around 12 to 1500 years ago. The two languages are like, it's kind of like Spanish and Portuguese, even a little bit more closely related. You know, people could come to understand each other. They intermarried. They lived side by side here in the Catskill Mountains and Hudson Valley. These languages, Muncie and Mohican, are in the Algonquian language family, which now occasionally I'll hear people talk about an Algonquian people. There is no such thing as an Algonquian people in the Hudson Valley. There's no Algonquian language in Hudson Valley. There is a community of people called Algonquian that live up in Canada in the Ottawa River Valley. That name is what's used by linguists to describe a huge language family spoken across the northern part of the North American continent. Right, that's Algonquian. But there are no people called Algonquian here. There are people who speak Algonquian languages. They call themselves Lenape in the Hudson Valley. All their descendants out in their displaced communities today still use the word Lenape, or in Mohican, the Nalpa, just pronounced a little bit differently. I bring up their languages a lot because their language, as in any culture, is really a key to understanding their thought world and their relationship with the other species and the land here. And it's really one of the only ways we can understand their relationship in the past when they were still living in their homeland, because they've been displaced for so long. So
these guys,
plantains.
Yeah, they're one of the most ignored plants. And I just want to point, we do have our several native species of plantain, or plantain, some people say. We also have non-native species, at least two, that are found commonly. It's actually hard to differentiate our native one, Plantago rugellii, from the more common non-native one. A biologist from the Moravian Town Reserve, a Lenape guy, told me that the native ones have red stems at the base. Mm. These are green at the base, so I assume this is the European one. But I'm pointing these out because they have my favorite name, I think, for a medicinal plant in the Munsee language. This is called Anayapasikan, which means trail medicine or path medicine. And as you can see, it's growing in a trail or a path. Mm-hmm. Plantain really likes to grow in compacted soil where people walk all the time or animals walk all the time. And I find that this lowly little plant that's easily ignored is the quickest for children to remember when you're showing them medicinal plants. You could show them something showy like jewelweed, and I find they will forget that quicker than plantain, which is used throughout the world topically on your skin for things like insect bites and bruises and cuts. I have a scar on my fingertip where I almost cut the tip of my finger off pruning tomatoes when I was a teenager. I was way out, far away from a house, and I chewed up some plantain and put it on my finger, and the bleeding stopped and it healed. I'm not recommending plantain. It's not the best plant for that purpose. It's better for insect bites. But it is used by Lenape people in all their communities in skin medicines. And, I mean, you'll see it growing in sidewalks in cities, too. It really is a path to medicine plant. And in Algonquin languages, like the Lenape dialects, they combine morphemes or sounds with meaning to create words and sentences, actually. So the ending in that word, Anayapasikan, Apasika, and you can't say that alone. It has to be combined with other morphemes. It turns a word into medicine. So, and that first part, Anai, means a trail or road.
Cool.
All right, so I stopped here. It's not the most interesting part of the property, but actually there are all sorts of plant species in here. Some native, some not native, some invasive. But I'm really stopping here for these staghorn sumacs. And right now, driving on the roads around here, you'll notice the sumac trees are all brilliantly red and orange and yellow. They look like fire sometimes. And you can see a few of the leaves that are left still have that beautiful red color. And I just am pointing these out because we have four species in the Hudson Valley. None of them are poisonous. Poison sumac, totally, it's a different genus. It's really rare in the Hudson Valley. It only grows, as far as I know, in calcareous bogs, which is kind of an oxymoron, because bogs are really acidic and calcium dissolves easily, so they're like, you don't run into those very often. So our sumac species that are not poisonous, like this staghorn sumac, they're really important, actually, for Native people. In fact, there's more you can do with a sumac than almost any other shrub. They provide dyes of different shades, red, black, brown. They provide food, so the young shoots in the springtime are actually really good. The fruit on sumacs, and I'm sure many of you in eating cuisine from the Middle East and parts of the Mediterranean have had sumac. It's used in different spice mixes. You can do the same thing with our native sumacs. The fruits are really sour. They're covered in malic acid, which is what makes Sour Patch Kids sour. So you can make sumacade, and that is a traditional beverage for native people in the Northeast. But they also provide all sorts of medicines, and the color that their leaves turn in the fall, that red color, shows kind of their medicinal potency to native people in the Northeast, for whom red is a color that they associate with life, with blood. And so the leaves traditionally, when they turn red, are dried and they're mixed with tobacco. Tobacco for native peoples throughout North and South America being kind of a medium of exchange with the supernatural world, with creative forces in the world. So for them, tobacco is, you know, that's what you use in offerings. When you burn it, the smoke lifts your prayers up. And sumac, if not as a substitute, at least is mixed with tobacco traditionally so that it's not so strong. Because the tobacco they grow has 9 times more nicotine than a tobacco used in cigars and cigarettes. And I know from growing traditional Lenape tobacco varieties that when you harvest it, if you're not careful, it gets absorbed through your skin. And I've trembled before from it. It's really a horrible feeling. But Excuse me. Anyway, anytime you see the sumacs red, just remember, you know, it's a reminder of, you know, of the presence and the thousands of years native of people have been in this continent. When I say that it's traditionally mixed with tobacco everywhere in the continent, I mean everywhere. From the Great Basin in Nevada, deserts in the southwest, the southeast, up here, of course, where it's really important for Haudenosaunee people and Lenape people. Literally everywhere sumac grows in North America, it is mixed with tobacco and it turns red by native people. So it's my favorite shrub or group of shrubs. And I just have to point that out. In the Mohican community, in their reservation in Wisconsin, the reservation of the Stockbridge Mohican people, they call this plant red whips today in English. The Mohican language has not been spoken, by the way, as a first language since 1940, but they do have a language department working on bringing their language back. But they call this red whips, and I asked an elder last year why they call this red whips, and he said, well, if you grew up here in my time, you'd know why they called it that. Actually, the Mohican word I found in my work, in a vocabulary from the 1760s, and it's makwipna, which means red stem tree. And that weep part in it refers to a stem or an arrow. And in one story that I was able to find that hasn't been published, the stem from a Hudson Valley displaced native Lenape community, these stems are used by the protagonist in the story as arrows to kill a witch. Mm. Because that's how powerful these are. And this plant, this shrub, is found throughout the northern part of North America. And it's important to Native people throughout North America. It's very important in the Great Plains. It's important for Haudenosaunee and Lenape people, who both use it similarly as a medicine, where if you scrape upward, it functions as an emetic, which you can use as a ritual emetic for purification, vomiting. If scraped downward, it cleans you out in the other direction. The whipping part, by the way, is not a form of corporeal punishment. So the whipping he was describing was not to inflict pain on children. Traditionally, for many Northeastern Native people, certain bad behavior can be driven out of people through the power of water or plants by praying to the plant or water and asking for its help to drive whatever is causing the bad behavior out of them. So more like the kids are being tapped by it. To try to drive what's causing the bad behavior out. They weren't actually being whipped to the point of, you know, terrible pain. But anytime you see this red color, which is very red in the wintertime when the snow is out, another reminder of, you know, a plant that's really spiritually important for Native people throughout the North American continent where it grows. Every name I've seen in the Lenape language for this plant basically means red stem.
Listen, you mentioned Lenape and Haudenosaunee as two different peoples a few times, but I don't know if everyone understands, you know, where each person lived or each group lived.
Yeah, so you
it
have
could be worth two, explaining.
So two language families are native to this state and to the Northeast. One is the Iroquoian family, and back in the day, and really to this day, is traditionally spoken on the western side of the mountains, of the Appalachian Mountains, Catskills. That includes languages like those spoken by the Haudenosaunee people or people of the Longhouse, like Mohawk or Oneida being the closest ones to here. And Mohawk is still spoken by many people today in some of their communities, both within New York and in Ontario and Quebec. Now, Iroquoian languages like Mohawk they're no more related to Algonquian languages like the Lenape dialects than they are to English. These are distinct language families. If they come from a common ancestor, it is so far back, linguists can't even trace it. We're talking like 10,000 plus years, maybe longer. They still share a few words. Their words for birds, amphibians, and reptiles are often the same, especially if they're onomatopoeia, describing the call of the bird. So I was hearing some people talking about the Mohawk robin dance before. Lenape used to have the same dance, and their word for the bird's almost the same. It's chishkokos, and a very similar word used in Mohawk. But they lived side by side as neighbors. They fought, mostly. We can see this archaeologically. They didn't like each other for the most part. And to this day, I've noticed, even though there's a lot of intermarriage between Lenape and Haudenosaunee people, there's still, you know, memories going back to those conflicts 300 plus years ago. But their songs and dances are shared. They're more often than not identical. Their creation story is basically the same. Their rituals are basically the same. They're just very different language groups. Their way of life back in the day and today is pretty much the same too. So it's really just a division by language more than anything. Well, anyone know what's going on here?
Beaver.
Yeah, this is a few years ago. It's a beaver. Now, the local Mexican name, one of their names, they have lots of different words for beaver, depending on the age, time of year, and the sex of the beaver. That is also true for bears and deer in many Algonquin languages. You could just say the word for deer, atol, but more, you'd be more likely to say the name if you saw a deer, depending on whether it was a year old or 3 years old, or was a mother or a buck with antlers or not. There's about 12 words, I think 12 words for deer and for bears, depending on the time of year, sex, and their time of their life. Same with beavers, that the local Mexican word for beaver seems to have been tamanqua, and that means tree cutter, and you can see why. In other languages, Algonquin languages in the Northeast, they're nicknamed Red Teeth. I've seen lots of cartoon beavers and they have white teeth. They don't have white teeth. Beavers have like almost carrot orange teeth. They're really weird looking. Yeah. And I mean, that's a small tree I've seen beavers cut down trees this big in diameter. It's amazing how they can do that. Though those teeth are traditionally used by Northeastern native people as chisels for wood. If you imagine an animal able to cut down a tree this big without losing their teeth, you can use that for a lot of woodworking without much resharpening. So, very useful tool. But there was a beaver hunting season. I guess you could say there still is, because there are some Lenape people who still hunt beavers, and that's in late winter or early spring when there's still ice. Back in the day, they would go to wetlands, which were much more common than they are today. Oh, look at that flying over us. See the blue jay screaming at that. I can't tell.
Was that a paraffin?
I'm having trouble telling. It looks like a falcon.
A little booby falcon.
Yeah.
You know your stuff.
Yeah, it looks like the blue jay really did not like it. That was cool. Well, beaver hunt, the meat actually is really good. It's a very tender red meat. And as you imagine, the pelts are really, really soft and water resistant, because they are mammals that live in water. And they're bigger than you think. I caught a beaver once that was over 70 pounds.
Wow.
They get huge.
Wow.
But they're very human-like. They live in houses. And we don't have a beaver lodge inside here. But the traditional houses used by Lenape people here were usually single-family dwellings, and they had the same dome shape, and their word for that house is wikulam, which you might recognize. That's one of dozens of words from their languages that came into American English. When the settlers came here, there were all sorts of plants and animals and technologies they were not familiar with, so they borrowed the words from their native neighbors. And the same thing happened in the other direction. So for people speaking native languages here, like Lenape or Mohawk, they borrowed words from Dutch and from English, from their settler neighbors. And if you want a list of names for animals or plants coming from Algonquin languages into English, I'd be happy to do that, but I'm not going to do that right now. And I just want to mention the fur trade very briefly, because that's what brought the settlers here in the first place. When the Dutch came here in the early 1600s, it was not to settle, but to trade. The Netherlands at the time was the most prosperous country in Europe, and by the standards of the 17th century, one of the most tolerant places in Europe. That's where you went if you were persecuted for your religion or for other reasons. So Huguenots moved there, Sephardic Jews moved to the Netherlands. The Puritans, some of them moved from England to the Netherlands, but it was too tolerant for their taste. So then they came to Massachusetts to inflict their puritanical ways on the people here. I'll step away from that. I really don't like the New Englanders in the 17th century. They were horrible people. The Dutch were not as bad. They had rules, because the Dutch West India Company that came here had a trading monopoly on their colony in the Hudson and Delaware Valleys. They had to buy land from native people. They couldn't just take it, because they didn't want to upset the indigenous people, because that would cost them money. War is expensive, and transporting people over the Atlantic in 1620, let's say, was not easy. So they had rules. didn't work very well. If you imagine living in the most prosperous part of country in Europe, a place where even a servant girl could buy, if she had enough money or could save enough money, could buy into a company like the Dutch West India Company, nobody wanted to come here. So the people you had coming overseas were either adventurers or people who were leaving for a reason. Those were the people coming from the Netherlands here that the Lenape people and the Mohawks and others had to deal with. Not necessarily the best people. A lot of wars happened as a result, even though the Dutch West India Company didn't want them. And that would shape their relationship with one another over the coming centuries. Eventually, by the 18th century, the Lenape people here were a minority in their own land. They were still here. They still had power. Even though they were a tiny minority in their own country, they still held title to most of the land of their own homeland. And it would be really another 100 years till they would be forced out. Not just because of conflict, not just because of disease or alcohol, which had become a problem, but because of environmental degradation. So you see the Catskill Mountains behind, and if you notice, the lower part of the mountains are still kind of greenish and colored, and the top, all the leaves are off the trees. That's not just elevational difference. The lower slopes are dominated by oak trees today, and they were back then. In fact, anywhere if you travel over the Catskill Mountains, on this side, you'll see lots of white oak trees. You'll see sweet fern and blueberries in the understory. You get over the mountaintops. For 40 miles, all you see is sugar maples and beeches and hemlocks. You get to the east branch of the Delaware River by Margaretville, and white oak trees show up again. That's because you're going from native communities through the interior of the mountains, where people didn't spend a lot of time, back to where there were native communities back in the day, where they were shaping the landscape through burning for their hunting so dramatically that the tree species composition today still reflects that, which is really incredible. And their burning, their methods they used for land management enriched biodiversity. They had beneficial effects on the landscape. And I know, you know, I don't think it's exaggerated to say that. Obviously, a biologist can't go back in time, as far as I know, to find that out for certain, but it's just, you know, it's obvious that in the places where they lived, where we can lay that on the map, is where you have the most biodiversity today, even with all the degradation that's happened from the settlers over the past 3.5 centuries, 4 centuries, really. And it was damming all the streams and overhunting and fire suppression and all the other things that were happening during colonization that led to the degradation that forced Native people out of their homeland here. You know, they were a minority in their own country, and they could not preserve their traditional way of life. So they had two choices, either to join a mission like the Stockbridge Mission, where they could preserve their identity and their tribal government, but learn how to live in the white man's world, learn, you know, colonial skills like weaving and building sawmills, or they could just get out of their homeland and move west and try to preserve their way of life. And that's exactly what happened. Some Native people from the Hudson Valley moved to Stockbridge. Their descendants now live in Wisconsin on the reservation today. The others ended up in Ontario and Oklahoma, mostly in Ontario. In fact, most of the Native people from here in Greene County and Ulster County ended up in Ontario because they were conservative and wanted to protect their traditional religion and way of life, which they would continue to practice in Ontario until the 1860s, and to an extent still today. But many of them converted to the Methodist and Anglican churches in the 1860s. It's a really long, complicated story, and there are not very many books published on it, but just in a nutshell of what happened. But you're still seeing their legacy on that mountain when you see all those oak trees. I mean, you're looking right now at what's, you know, basically the north side of the Catskill Mountains. That should not be dominated by oak trees. You know, that's that kind of microclimate. You would expect beeches and hemlocks. Those are there because of the fires Native people were conducting. And last conducted maybe in 1770, because the Catskill Indians, the Lenape group around here, they stayed in the area, some of them, until the Revolutionary War, but they were forced out after that. So they weren't doing any burns since then. Yeah, it's a type of viburnum. And they're called around here, I'm trying to remember, two different names, but my favorite one is Kakwahakanimenji, which means mortar tree, like a mortar for pounding corn. And the traditional mortar, you can see, by the way, if you want to see a mortar and pestle for pounding corn from Greene County or from Ulster County, They're in all different collections. You can see one at Historic Huguenot Street, one at the Senate House in Kingston, or you could go on a computer, digital collections of the National Museum of the American Indian. You can look up mortars from the native people around here. They have a very distinct shape. Obviously, they need to be made out of very, very hard cross-grained wood because you're pounding corn and nuts in it all the time. You don't want it to crack and break. Nanny berries tend to grow small, but sometimes the trunks are large enough that you can make them into pestles for pounding corn. So that's why that's one of their names for that tree. But the fruit is also edible, which is why I wanted to get some, and I'm going to look for more. They have a very interesting flavor. They're very dry. To me, they kind of taste like a date, but a little bit less sweet. They have a huge seed in the middle. Traditionally, from my understanding, just like choke cherries, Native people pounded them in the back in the day into smithereens, seed and all, until they're pulverized and dry them as cakes for winter usage. And that's one of the few berries you can harvest into the winter. If the birds don't get them, they will hang on sometimes until February, along with cranberries and sometimes hawthorns and high bush cranberries, which are actually viburnum. This is the preferred wood back in the day for building a house, a wigwam or a longhouse. So these young straight hickories have extremely strong flexible wood, but have the added benefit that you can peel the bark off in strips, especially in the springtime, and then use that for tying the frame together. It is also one of the preferred woods for hunting bows by Native people throughout the Northeast. And the nuts of the hickory tree, which fell down a couple of weeks ago, were a huge source of food, a staple for Native people throughout the eastern woodlands, so throughout eastern North America. The word hickory itself comes from Algonquin languages, from one of the dialects in Virginia. Has anyone here ever eaten a hickory nut? So a couple people. Has anyone here ever eaten a pecan before?
Yeah.
So that's a type of hickory tree. So pecans are a hickory, and we have our closest hickory species to pecan in the Northeast is the bitternut hickory, which is not edible as is, although you can press edible oil out of it. And actually, in the Mexican language and in all the Lenape dialects, the word pecan just is a generic word for nut. So that puck part in it refers to cracking something. Another example is, anyone seen the historic sign when you drive over the bridge in Leeds and you see that big field in the flats and there's a sign that says there was a Catskill Indian community there?
Yeah.
So that sign says that their community there was called Pukwaiik. That puck part is in that too. It refers to a flat area of land or cleared area of land. In fact, that may have been the name that the local Lenape people called themselves, was Pukwaiik, which was their largest community, and it kind of describes all the flatland along the Catskill Creek Valley. But yeah, pecan is their generic word for nut. Although they have other words for hickory. In a local Mexican dialect, their word for this species, the shagbark hickory, is kiskatamina. Anyone recognize the word kiskatamin?
Kiskatam.
Yep.
Kiskatam.
Exactly. Kiskatam, New York, is named for either a huge shagbark hickory or a lot of shagbark hickories being there. And the word, that when the Dutch came here, they didn't know what hickory trees were. Hickories don't grow in Europe. They are found in Eastern Asia and Eastern North America, along with a ton of other plants, actually. We actually have twin forest ecosystems between Korea and parts of China and Japan and Eastern North America. But anyway, the Dutch didn't know what to call hickory. They borrowed the local Mexican word from Greene County, and they called them Kiskatamis nuts. In both, that was in English, but in English and Dutch in Hudson Valley, they were called Kiskatamis nuts for 200 years. I don't know when they stopped getting called that. A lot of local, you know, vocabulary and slang just died out over time. But the shagbark has the best nuts, I think, of all of our local hickory trees. I wish I could show you some and crack them open, but I don't want to spend a ton of time going through the leaf litter, and I think the squirrels got most of them. No, and there should have been a ton. I will note a few other cool things with shagbark hickories. The shaggy bark, which gives them their name, if you ever need a quick torch, you just grab a few of those and bundle them together and you light one end, and that will burn for a good 15, 20 minutes if you make it right, and it's very, very bright and extremely hot. If you want to cook in the woods quickly and you don't want to wait an hour for your fire to burn down to coals, you just pick hickory bark again. If you've ever had hickory smoked meat or food, mm-hmm. use that bark. You can soak it in water and then throw it in your grill, and it'll make that nice hickory smoke flavor. If you have a neighbor that you really don't like and you want to burn their house down, you can make flaming arrows using hickory bark, which was used traditionally. In fact, Daniel Boone, when he was in his frontier blockhouse somewhere in Kentucky in the 1770s and had really been pissing off local Shawnee and Lenape people, some of whom had been driven from here out in that direction by that point, he was under siege in his blockhouse by angry warriors, and they set fire to it with hickory bark flaming arrows.
Right.
So another good thing to know about shagbark hickory trees. I will note one more thing. A lot of people, when I've asked if they've eaten hickory or not, say, if they say yes, they complain about how much work it is to shell them and how hard it is to extract the meat. And nut meat is actually fairly large. It's bigger than you would think in a nut that's this big, but they're very hard and it's hard to get it out whole. Traditionally, Eastern Woodlands peoples usually don't try to get the nut meat out whole. In fact, there are accounts of Native people back in the day in different parts of the Eastern United States harvesting hundreds of bushels of hickory nuts, like unfathomably huge amounts. When they wanted them for food, they pounded them to smithereens, they pulverized them in large quantities, and then simmered them in water so that the nut, the shell fragments and the meat fragments separate. The shells sink and the nut meats float. I always mix that up. Every year I have to relearn that when I do that myself, and every year I forget and scramble it, because for other things the shells float. In between you have nut milk, which is traditionally used in cooking. It's what gives the word hickory, actually. And then the nut meats can be taken out and dried or cooked into other dishes. When it's allowed to cool, oil can be skimmed off the top. And they would put away gallons of hickory oil for use in cooking and cosmetics. And it's a very good nut oil.
Wow.
And if you're lazy, you can just go and get store-bought pecans already cracked and make nut milk with it. It requires a good amount of simmering, though, to make it properly, and it gets a very sweet flavor. They're so common. They're one of the few trees that are doing pretty well with our overpopulation of deer and climate change. Anyone know what tree this is? Yeah, a bunch of people said it's a white oak. You can see the round lobes on the leaves. And it's called white oak because when it gets bigger, they have whitish colored bark. It's really more ash colored. And in fact, in some Lenape dialects, the word for white oak means ash colored tree or gray tree. The oaks are divided into two groups in our, Western taxonomy. They're divided into the white oak group and red oak group. Generally, red oak type acorns are much more bitter tasting and white oak acorns are less bitter tasting, but that's not necessarily true. There are a few other differences, but Lenape people also classify oak trees into those two groups. They also differentiate the different species of oaks, but their word for red oak group trees means basically bitter tasting tree. And their word for white oak group trees means edible nut tree. Pakakiminji, actually that pak word isn't it again, refers to pounding the acorns to leach the tannins out and make them into acorn bread or into acorn mush. And I only learned recently that there are still a few Lenape families in the displaced community of the Delaware tribe in eastern Oklahoma who use traditional methods to process acorns. So that tradition is still being passed down in some of their communities today, or at least in one of them, which I thought was really cool because usually, at least on the East Coast, the knowledge of processing acorns died out 100, 150 years ago. But there are some people still doing it in some families. But anyway, this tree, the white oak tree, became one of the most, if not the most common large trees in the Hudson Valley, exclusively because of Native people managing the landscape in some areas with fire. You can see this in the pollen record. When you look at pollen in lake and bog sediments, so you can see what tree species were around 500 years ago or 8,000 years ago, but also in charcoal deposits from fires, you can see what wood was the most common. And there was, over the past 2,000 years, a shift throughout the eastern woodlands to white oak trees being the most dominant tree in places where Native people lived. And that's significant. White oak trees do well with fire because they grow really thick bark that protects them. And when their acorns germinate, they need preferably full sunlight in order to grow into a big tree. Other oak species like red oaks can do okay in the shade. It's why they're more common in the interior Catskills, where native people were not setting fire. White oak tree is also significant because it produces a lot of sweet acorns that all sorts of animals like. In fact, over the past month, if you walked around woods with white oak trees, you might have noticed broken branches all over the ground from bears climbing up them. They get impatient before the acorns drop, and they break down the branches a month in advance. But white oak trees also are unique in supporting more pollinator species than any other deciduous tree in the Northeast. So their leaves are the host for, I forget how many hundred caterpillar species. So they themselves are a tree that supports biodiversity in that regard. And when they get big and their bark starts to come off in plates, they're the preferred roosting place for many of our smaller bat species. Now, I will also note that we are losing white oak trees very slowly over the landscape because of our overpopulation of deer and the suppression of fires. Back in the day, there were far fewer deer in much of the landscape, in part because there were predators still around, like wolves and mountain lions, which have both have been gone for 250 years around here. But there was also tremendous pressure upon their populations by native people in hunting them. It was not an unsustainable hunt. They had many rules for deer hunting that would not have destroyed their populations. They had set seasons for hunting, rules about when you could, how many you could get. But they kept their numbers low enough that it allowed white oaks to become dominant. When you have too many deer, you lose oak trees. And seeing a white oak tree that's this size is actually really not common in many areas around here. You'll see lots of big ones, very, very few that are saplings. You'll see little ones germinating, but over the course of the winter, the deer eat them until they're gone. So if you have a white oak tree, a little one in your backyard, it is worth protecting from deer. These, I think they're Scotch pines. Some of these are our native white pines, but if you notice these pines that are all growing in rows, they're probably, I'm guessing it's a Scotch pine plantation, although sometimes red pines are planted as well. I can't tell based on the lighting, they could be red pines. Pitch pines are found in this area. We've lost almost all of them over the past 50 years because of fire suppression. Places like Round Top, you know, the little round mountain, Hodic Mountain between Athens and Cairo, the whole Catskill Escarpment were covered in pitch pines. In fact, you'll still see them on roadsides throughout Cairo and Round Top and Acre today. So we're losing them from fire suppression. This is a good example of the legacy of settlers planting trees in straight rows, that are trees that are not necessarily native to the area, and they slowly, you know, they don't do so well, and they'll be gone in no time. Whereas the methods used by the Lenape people and Haudenosaunee people here created a forest ecosystem that, even though it's been clear-cut multiple times over in most areas, still is returning to what it was before to an extent. I know people are always looking for stone walls, like that stone wall over there, as like a legacy left by native people, but that's such a Western way to think. Let's try to see like human legacy in stonework. Because building with stone is not traditional for native people in the Northeast, with the exception of stone monument piles, which were huge and most of which were taken apart by settlers for use in making foundations and stone fences like that. The stone walls are very well documented. And it's just, I always find it funny when people are looking for native people through stone structures, because they left a way cooler legacy, and that's a biodiverse forest ecosystem. You know, it's a different perspective, I think, of leaving something that's okay, lasting and visible on the earth. Mm-hmm. So we've actually passed by quite a few of these, but I wasn't stopping to point them out. But does anyone know what this is? I mean, this will grow like 20 feet tall. Anyone know what this is?
Is that the invasive maple?
It's not invasive, actually, but it is a maple. And that's one of the names, and I like that name a lot because it. So someone called out moose maple, and the word moose in local Lenape languages is the word for moose and for elk. They literally say moose. It's one of their loan words that came into English. Locally, there are no moose, and there were no moose 500 years ago, but we had elk around here. And this was one of the preferred winter browses for elk when they lived in the area. And there were still elk in the Catskill Mountains until the early 1800s, at least on the western side near Delhi today, out in the east branch of the Delaware River. And not very long ago, just 250 years ago, where we are right now, if you, at this time of year in the evening, you might hear the sound of elks bugling over the mountains. If you have not heard that sound, I highly recommend going online on YouTube or on the Macaulay Library of Sounds and listening to what an elk sounds like bugling, an American elk, because it is the most amazing ethereal sound, full of overtones. It's not like the elk or red deer in Europe that just kind of sound like a big belch. Like, it's really magical. And their word for them is moose. And in some native languages, this is called elk or moose tree or bush, as well as in English, sometimes this is known as a moose maple. It's also called striped maple. When they get bigger, they're very stripy. Foresters really don't like these because after a selective logging or a high grading, this will come in first. They are an understory tree. They'll take advantage of the sudden sunlight and they'll completely fill an area so that there's no other tree regeneration. So
but
they don't like
native,
them.
Right? Hmm? But they're native.
They are native. But if we still had elk here, the elk would be browsing them and maybe would allow the tree regeneration. Deer actually don't like these very much. This is one of the few native trees that deer don't really browse. So it's something that the elk were eating and deer were not. So I just think that's a fun one because of that. Don't have much else to say on it, although some people, like Anna, have called this Adirondack toilet paper. The leaves are very big and soft.
Really big.
Yes. I stopped here to point out how the forest is changing. Yeah. So, you know, we're in a pine plantation, but you could see in the sunnier areas, you have native pioneer species like those birch trees coming up. Pioneer because they're the trees that grow the quickest, they need full sunlight, and they're the first to come in. What? Okay. And you also see a few larger slits, this red oak right here. This probably came up, around the time that they planted plantation, if not earlier. It looks older than me. Oak trees are generally much more slow growing. But if you notice all the trees with the yellowish leaves, these are all climax tree species. None of them do well with fire. They're what the forest wants to be here. Many of those are sugar maples. Some of them are red oak. Some of them are American beech. Some are black cherries. These are what the forest wants to be like without disturbance, without fire. They do fine in shade. So they're doing fine underneath in the dappled light underneath these white pines and the pine plantation. And eventually they're gonna grow over these pine trees, shade them out, and this will go back to being a sugar maple dominated forest or beech. It would be a beech dominated forest, except all our beech trees are dying from beech bark disease and a new foliar disease. And actually I'll just note right now, so does anyone here know about passenger pigeons? So for those who don't, passenger pigeons are an extinct bird that only went extinct fairly recently. Anyone know what day they went extinct? I think 1930s, the last one lived in a zoo, actually. But they were the most abundant flying bird on the planet for 20,000 years, at least. They flew in flocks numbering in the millions, and they nested where their forests were dominated by American beech trees. And the Catskill Mountains, which were pretty much untouched by fire in the interior, were a very much beech-dominated ecosystem. So, unfortunately, I don't have a good example beech tree here, but you imagine these giant, smooth, gray trunks. They're buttressed. They almost look like elephant's legs and feet, spreading into these huge branches, and they drop like little chestnuts, basically, which are marginally edible for humans. I mean, they can be, but they're not as good as a chestnut or a hickory nut, I don't think. But these pigeons relied on them for their survival. They would nest in colonies that were so large that the branches from trees would break from the weight of all the bird nests on them. And in some places, people saw guano build up to a foot deep in one four or five week nesting season. That's how big these flocks were. You can only imagine the effect they had on forest ecosystems, not just through nitrogen deposition from their guano, but all those baby pigeon squabs and all the adult birds that would, you know, die from disease or because they crashed into each other or because sometimes the trees would collapse and kill them because there was too much weight. Those were feeding bears and fishers and raccoons and all sorts of other animals and people. And there is still a pigeon dance performed by Haudenosaunee people today that back in the day was performed before the pigeon hunt in the springtime, when they would hunt the pigeons in their nesting colonies and knock the baby pigeons or squabs out of trees to smoke and dry them for the rest of the year and make oil from them for cooking. And the Lenape people here also probably had a pigeon dance, but if they did, their communities no longer have it, as far as I know. But you can go on YouTube and see Seneca and other Haudenosaunee people performing the pigeon dance today. And I have heard that they also make the pigeons cries at some points during the dances. I've never heard that during a dance, but I really would like to hear that, because as far as I know of passenger pigeon, there's no audio recording of what they sounded like. However, the Munsee name for passenger pigeon, in fact, in all the Lenape languages, their name for them is Amimi, which describes their call or one of the sounds that they made. I'm not going to try to make that sound for you. I have no idea what that would have been like. But usually their name for birds describe their call. We also do that in English. Can anyone think of any American English names for birds that also describe their call?
Chickadee.
Yeah, chickadee, bobwhite.
Tippet.
Yep. Chickadee, and by the way, in the Lenape dialect, it's machchililis. So, trying to think. Bobwhite, that one actually is, that one's a weird one. It doesn't describe their call. But usually they do the same thing. So their word for in the Mexican language, the word for raven is conconca. The word for crow is ajas, so describing their call. The word for blue jay is titis. If you ever hear a blue jay going titis, the word for pileated woodpecker is meme, because they go meme, 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 meme. I'm not going to actually do that one. So, very descriptive of the bird's calls. Actually, their word for barred owl is kokos. And in some dialects, it's kaka kokoha. So, very, very descriptive. You might know that from a local place name. Kokos is found in place names like Koksaki, which means a land country that's full of owls, specifically barred owls. And in many Algonquin language place names, that usually describes a place where barred owls like to live that's very shady and full of evergreens like hemlocks or cedars. So I know of at least three different Lenape places named Koksaki or Koksaking because of how dark and shady they were. There's still a lot of arguing over what Koksaki means today. There should not be, because we have multiple records of native people from the area saying what it means, and it's also a very easily translatable one. But just another fun little one, and it also describes a barred owl's call. There is still wild rice in the Hudson River. We were actually out last week with a group of Lenape people visiting their homeland here from all their communities, and we were looking at wild rice with them out at Nori Point. But they didn't grow it. They, through their harvesting methods, may have encouraged it to grow. But wild rice was not a big staple for native people here. We know they were harvesting it. We have records of it, both archaeologically and in the written record. But it's not a staple the way it is for other Algonquin peoples or Siouan peoples out in the Great Lakes. Corn was grown in such quantities here that they didn't really have a reason to harvest wild rice other than, you know, to add something to their diet. But likely before the introduction of corn and other domestic plant foods over the past 2,000 years, they were harvesting more wild rice. Okay. And I bet if you contacted a Menominee or Ojibwe person today who still harvests wild rice, they would tell you whether what they are doing encourages it to grow. And I'm guessing it probably did. But not cultivation like as a row crop, you know? More like a semi-cultivated plant. Any other questions?
I have a question. You mentioned fire a couple times.
Oh, yeah.
In context, like intentionally setting it or not. I'm just wondering, like, if you could just explain the role of fire, intentionally, unintentionally, in forestry.
So their question is about their role of fire in their land management. And they were setting fires primarily in the fall, which was their deer hunting season, which ran from November until early January, as long as there was not snow in the ground. And it was extremely well organized and planned. Unfortunately, those large-scale burns have not been performed by Lenape people for 200 plus years. So we don't know exactly how they were organized in their homeland. But we have a few eyewitness accounts from the 17th century describing multiple communities getting together and choosing the leaders who were elders, choosing where they were going to burn that year. They were very strategic. If you burned the same place year after year, you would turn it into a treeless prairie ecosystem. If you burned somewhere every 10 to 50 years, you would clear out the underbrush, encourage certain tree and plant species, but allow it to be forest. Places that were burned, you know, every 5 to 10 years would become a savanna with widely spread white oak trees and maybe some other black oaks or chestnuts or hickories. So they were very strategic. They did end up creating prairies. There are descriptions from the 17th and 18th centuries of treeless expanses in Hudson Valley that were 5 miles wide without any trees. The area around Claveret from Kinderhook down to Germantown, New York, was described as pretty much treeless when the settlers first showed up. Only trees growing down along the river courses, along the creeks like Claveret and Taconic Creek. And the fact that pitch pines are still found in the area of Caro today, then down to Sandy Plains, down towards Catskill, shows that much of that area was also probably partially treeless from their burning. But we know it was very well organized, just not exactly how they did it. They said that they were burning in order to improve their hunting grounds. We know that by burning these low-intensity burns, I say low-intensity in that they would burn the grass and leaf litter and not go up and burn all the trees, although that would happen at times, especially if there were pitch pines. We know that by doing that, you bring in new plant species and then new insect and animal species that require more sunlight or are dependent on fire. You also get more fruit. So blueberries will produce much more fruit after a burn, in part because of the nutrients the ashes are releasing, but also because of the boost in sunlight. That's also true for wild grapes, blackberries, all different nut trees. So all those extra fruit crops, hazelnuts, another example, there are descriptions of entire plains covered in American hazelnuts on Catskill and Catterskill Creek near here, and that would have been in part through because of the use of fire. Hazelnuts do very well after burns. You're getting more plant foods for humans as well as animals that lived here. Not just deer, but also elk and bears, wild turkeys, heath hens, passenger pigeons, sandhill cranes. These are all fauna that you would have seen here 300, 400 years ago, many of which no longer exist here today, either because they're locally extirpated or are extinct. So they knew what they were doing with these fires. They're still conducted. I can say that because I know one elder, again from the Moravian Town Reserve in Ontario, he sets fire to his lawn every year in order to encourage morel mushrooms to come up in the spring. They love morel. By the way, every Northeastern Native person I've met, doesn't matter whether they're Lenape or Haudenosaunee or Abenaki, they all love morel mushrooms. It's almost the exclusive mushroom that's eaten by Eastern Woodlands peoples. There are a few other species eaten by some people, but they love morels. That's another side benefit of burning, is some morel mushroom species do really well after fire. In fact, there are apps you can download, I'm pretty sure, out for the Rocky Mountains and West Coast that track burns, so you know when the morel mushrooms are going to come up, right after a fire burned the year before, 6 months before. But that's not happening around here anymore, at least not very often. Maybe if you go down to Minnewaska or places where, or the Albany Pine Bush. What life was like back in the day, what their way of life was like. I've gone into different aspects of it, but just very quickly, I'll just note that, you know, around the time that the settlers first came here 400 years ago, Lenape people in the Hudson Valley were living in what archaeologists call dispersed settlement patterns. So their towns, their word for town is Otanai, that oak part in it, you see in the word totem, which it refers to a group coming from one descent. They're a matrilineal society, so, and that's true in most of their communities to this day, meaning you belong to your mother's family, to her clan, to her community. You would speak your mother's dialect or language. Their settlements were down and more permanent, down more towards these tributaries of the Hudson River, closer to the Hudson, on terraces over the floodplains. All those vast flat areas cultivated with corn today, on Catskill Creek, Catterskill Creek, then on the Esopus, Rondout, Wallkill, just as a few examples, those have probably been continuously cultivated with corn for 1,200 years. Those are where native people were growing their corn when they still lived here, and they lived safely out of the reach of floods on terraces of land over those cornfields. Those terraces of land are where the oldest houses and the oldest towns are in the Hudson Valley today. Places like historic Huguenot Street, Claverick, New York. There are a bunch of other places I could probably think of. So they lived in these dispersed communities where you had a couple houses here, then half a mile another house, then a mile away three more. the leader, which was a hereditary thing, the role of leadership descended through the maternal line. Generally, with exception, because their society is has strict gender roles, generally men would take public office, even though they're a very balanced society in terms of, you know, the power that these different gender roles had. Generally, men had a more public voice, but women would make the decision on the inside. But there are exceptions, and actually the Catskill and Esopus Indians in Ulster and Greene County were known for their female public leadership. But anyway, that descended through the female line, but was also kind of democratically elected by the lineage as a whole. The leader's house was called the Huatekan, or big house. That's the equivalent of Haudenosaunee people's longhouse. That's where the leader would live with their multiple spouses and their kids. And that's where politics happened. That's where public ceremonies happened. You know, that's where visiting emissaries would come to. And you find these archaeologically when you see post molds, the stains in the earth left by the frames of their houses. Now in the fall, most people would leave their communities and go up into the foothills to their hunting camps, set fire. Again, we don't know how that was organized necessarily, and hunt deer for a few months and then hunt bears in the wintertime. Elders who couldn't make the journey would stay home in their, you know, permanent houses and their permanent communities, and everyone would come back carrying loads of pelts and meat on them. The same thing happened in the springtime. Everyone would go down to closer to the Hudson River to catch all the fish coming to spawn. So we don't have salmon in the Hudson, but we have shad and alewives, herring, striped bass, short-nosed and Atlantic sturgeon, and snapping turtles and American eels. Those were all major sources of food they were getting from the Hudson River, besides aquatic plant food, not just wild rice, but golden club, arrow arum, and all sorts of other plants that were a staple in their diet in the springtime. So there are people who moved with the seasons but had permanent sedentary communities. I like to think of their hunting and fishing camps as vacation homes, yes, in a sense. Because they are, I mean, they're going places for a few weeks or months at a time where they had houses that they would repair, go and collect firewood, and then spend a few weeks or months there. Which I think is a very beautiful life. You're moving with the habitats. You're going from wetlands to the interior valleys, to the mountains, going to where the land had the most to give at that time of year, taking care of those places through their land management techniques, and, you know, getting your food, your resources from there, probably very sustainably. Now, I had mentioned how similar their culture is to Haudenosaunee people to our West. One of the few differences was their lifestyle. They both relied on growing corn. They both still are corn-based societies today. However, Haudenosaunee people traditionally lived in large concentrated towns surrounded by fortress, by palisade walls, in long houses. So whereas Lenape people here would be, you know, live in a whole community of small wigwams, all of one descent, Haudenosaunee people would live in a long house, all of one descent, where you'd have a mother and all of her sisters and their children and grandchildren living in a 100 to 200 foot long house. These things are huge. There might be a whole collection of longhouses surround up on a hilltop surrounded by a wall. So that's the one major difference between these two peoples besides language. Otherwise, their beliefs and their songs are mostly the same or close to the same. I will note that they also built forts here, but they didn't live in them. They would drive palisades, actually fairly large tree trunks into the ground in places of defense in times of war. Any questions before we return?
Wait, what is a palisade?
A palisade is like a wall or fence.
Okay.
And actually, it's related to the word pole. And if you've ever, what is the expression? Over the pale. I think that's it.
Beyond
the pale. Thank you. Beyond the pale means, that's coming from like the wars between the UK, Great Britain and Ireland back in the day. But the pale being the palisade or fence. The palisades down in the Hudson River, down across the river from Yonkers and the Bronx and Manhattan, they're named because they're like a giant wall. Mm-hmm. And the word pole is in that, I'm pretty sure. It's related to that.